Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, wow, it's time for Paranormal Down Under. This is Dr. John. Jackson Samuel, how are you doing down there, down under? You having a good time today?
I'm doing great today, thanks, Dr. John. Hope you're having a great one up there too, mate, and just saying hello to all of our listeners around the world.
That's right, and boy, we have them too. tell you what, Paranormal Down, well, all these shows from Scarycast to Bigfoot and Company to Paranormal Down Under, they're getting around all over, so we're glad to have everyone listening in. I mean, I think we had someone
from Egypt last time,
so whoever you are, thanks for listening in from the land of the pyramids and the Sphinx. We appreciate you very much. But anyway, yeah, we got a lot of
Most
great
definitely.
Stuff to talk about. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about tonight. Jackson, let me tell you what I put together, and I talked to you a little bit about it. Can I tell you a little bit about the Bigfoot Interaction Experience Scale? Can I tell you a little bit about it?
Do, and please share it with everyone else, because I was quite excited when I heard this.
Well, okay, great. Thank you. Here's the deal. When we go on the Weather Channel, that we use Weather Channel over here. When we go to the Weather Channel in the fall, all we hear about is the Saffir-Simpson scale, about Category 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 hurricane. That's all we hear about. And these things can just devastate. They really can. But we categorize them. We know what, you know, what they are. We know a Category 4 is horrible. We know a Category 1 as well. It, you know, it's kind of a tropical storm, but, you know, it'll be okay.
Yep.
So that's what we know, and that gives us a handle on how bad a hurricane is going to be. Now, we also have Dr. J. Allen Hynek. He had his
mm-hmm.
marvelous book about UFOs, and the title of one, he has a scale from 1 to 6 about interactions with UFOs. Now, as we know, there's that great movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and that's
Most
the
definitely.
Sixth, or the closest. That's the closest interaction you have. He talks about nocturnal light, you know, lights in the night, that's number one, daylight disks, radar visual cases, you know. Then we get to Close Encounters
yep.
of the First Kind, which is you're within 200 feet of the UFO. And then Close Encounters of the Second Kind, when the UFO actually interacts with the environment, like leaving some kind of physical evidence, like tearing down a tree and coming down. And then you have the Close Encounter of the Third Kind, where the occupants of a UFO are seen. That's a Close Encounter of the Third Kind. And we know what a Close Encounter of the Third Kind is. We, you know, we've got a good feel for that versus nocturnal light
yep.
and everything. Well, I've been yep. thinking about how do you categorize a Bigfoot experience. And it has to do, I think, with the interaction, the Bigfoot interaction experience. So I kind of came up with a scale. I was doing some research. I do, you know, Jackson, I guess once I got my doctorate, I really do research all the time. And I was looking at, because last night I had a really great guy on Scarycast. His name is William Rodriguez. And we were talking about several Bigfoot experiences in Northeast Georgia. And then you today, we start talking about one that is quite famous. I'm going to let you tell about it when we get to that point. But I said, you know, I've always been looking for a way to categorize Bigfoot interaction experience. Because when you're a scientist like I am, you like to have a handle where you can relate one experience or one sighting with another. So what I did was I put together, and a couple of drafts came through, and then I finally got it to where I wanted it. There are 9 different levels of interaction with Bigfoot. If you're having a sighting, first of all, I'm going to go, no, your number 8 is no sighting, no interaction, no evidence by the witness. We have the witness and the Bigfoot creature. And then number 7, we have evidence. And these are kind of like, and by the way, if you want to go to BigfootColumn.com. That's at ScaryCast. Go to ScaryCast.com, and the top link on the right is going to be a PDF of this, and so everybody can follow along. So we have no sighting, no interaction or evidence. Then we have evidence of a sighting, which could be footprints, property damage, sounds of the creature, and evidence of built structures. Rick Rellis of Bigfoot Research Organization certainly taught us about structures. And he did a great job at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, and he was on Bigfoot and Company the other week. Just a marvelous guy. Really enjoy talking to him about Bigfoot structures. So we have no sightings. We have evidence of Bigfoot. Then we have a witness sighting. That's when you, as a human being, see Bigfoot. But Bigfoot doesn't see you. No acknowledgement. Then there is a mutual sighting where you both see each other. Now, you both can see each other and just go on about your business. You really can. There are many times when that happens. Now, what I would say is that an example of a mutual sighting was the famous Patterson-Gimlin footage. That Bigfoot happened to look and see that there was a camera over there. Regardless of what you think about the sighting, it was mutual. That Bigfoot knew he or she was being watched, and the watcher, the human, knew they were watching Bigfoot. Okay?
Neither felt any threat, so they just moved on. They just acknowledged each other and moved on. Yeah.
Yep. I've got there. Yep. It says both parties simply left the scene. Next is a witness action. That's when the witness does something. Now, that's when the witness may scream. They may make a sound. They may assume some type of self-defense posture. They may, haul up a gun. They may do something. But the Bigfoot creature leaves the scene. All right? Next is when Bigfoot takes action. There's a mutual sighting, and Bigfoot takes action. Now, William last night was talking about a really neat situation. It was in the late 90s. There was a policeman from Clayton, Georgia, having lunch out in a park. And it was very, very late. And the policeman got up, was cleaning up his lunch and getting ready to leave, and looked over and saw something crouching in the weeds about 100, 150 feet away. And whatever that thing was, it was a Bigfoot creature. And it rose up. It was about 8 feet tall. And the policeman got very concerned when the Bigfoot took a step or two in his direction. So he got his gun out, said, "Stop, don't come any closer." Now, that is mutual interaction, because the Bigfoot then ran away. He ran up a hill, for better or worse. So I know the policeman was scared. So that's mutual interaction. That's when both parties do something. Number one is abduction, such as the very, very famous report of Albert Ostman. Now, Jackson, you're the one that reminded me of the famous Albert Ostman incident. Tell everybody a little bit about it in case they don't know. Can you narrate that story for us here, please?
I sure can.
Great, thank you.
Now, Albert Ostman, he had an encounter in 1927. He was in British Columbia. Oh, sorry, 1924. He was in British Columbia. He didn't report his sighting until 1957 because he thought people would think that he was crazy. Like, I suppose back in those times, if you reported something like that, you'd be locked up or you'd get a frontal lobotomy or something similar. But he was actually camping up in British Columbia, and he was awoken one night when something picked him up. He was in a sleeping bag, and he was picked up, and he played dead, and it was a large male squatch, large male Bigfoot, and this thing carried him for about 3 hours on his shoulder up to the main camp where the Bigfoot were living. The captors were three adults and a child, apparently. They held him for 6 days. The male was roughly 8 foot tall, they said, they basically fed him sweet-tasting grass And the way that he managed to escape was that he was eating chewing tobacco or was having snuff. And the big male Bigfoot became interested in what he was doing. So he offered some to him and he burned himself with it. And during the commotion, Albert managed to get away. And he kept that story secret for almost 30 years until he actually told people about his encounter. Like, that'd have to be like the main encounter that I reckon you could possibly have, being abducted and kept with them for 6 days and living with them. Like, what he must have gone through would have been incredible.
It must have been. I mean, if you had enough wherewithal in your mind and if your family wasn't so worried about you, you could actually do it and enjoy it, because I don't think that if they took you to their camp that they would be doing anything against you. I just don't. I mean, I think Bigfoot can be vicious if Bigfoot is provoked, but I think Bigfoot would not be vicious if it was not provoked. So anyway, that is
the way that I feel it. Well, when you were just saying, like, that when that police officer pulled his gun, Bigfoot ran away, they're obviously used to firearms. They've seen them before. They take it as a threat, so that's why they'd run. Albert didn't have anything.
Right.
He was asleep. He was in a sleeping bag, and, you know, he didn't pose a threat to them, and they were obviously interested in him and wanted to find out more about him, like we want to find out more about them.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think it's... I think you know, having a scale like this is a good thing. Of course, the zero is injury or is finally injury or death on the part of one or both parties. So this scale has 9 levels. I'm going to send this to several of my friends that are Bigfoot researchers and Bigfoot explorers, and I'm going to see what they think. I think it's important. Like, here's an example of how I would like to use this scale. Like, Northeast Georgia is ripe with Bigfoot sightings. So why don't we color code the sightings, starting with evidence, maybe light red, and go to dark red for the abductions. Therefore, that gives us an idea of where it might be safe. You know, it might be safe if there's witness action or Bigfoot action or even mutual interaction. When you get to the abductions and potential life-threatening situations, I think it's good to know. So it's a good way to color code. That's, you know, Jackson, that's a lot like over here in the United States when we have those maps about rain and snow. You know, it gets a darker blue the more rain you've got.
And
you guys
have
those too. Yeah. Right. And I think that's a good thing. It's a way to kind of let you know what the experience might be like or what has the experience been there. So I think an interaction experience scale is an important thing to look at. Now, not everyone has to use it, but I would hope that folks would use it in the spirit in which I put it together, so to help collect data. And I know for fact, Jackson, that each one of these or at least most of these categories are going to have subcategories. Like the mutual interaction, you know, was one threatening, was it not threatening? You know, there'll be a number of, this will help. When you put, anytime you have a code, a way to code up something, I know that, like, all over the world we use medical coding to determine the experience that people had, what was done to them, you know, and all that. So here we have a way to code up what was done, and it's just easier to analyze data when you have a coding system. And it's not a very hard one.
Exactly.
It goes from 8, which is nothing, to 0, to death or injury. So, I mean, I think it's not that hard. And I mean, we all pretty much know the Dr. J. Allen Hynek scale for UFOs. I guarantee you, Angelia Shear, who's head of Tennessee MUFON, I guarantee you, John Dixon knows it, who's an investigator. They all know it, and it's easy. We all know the Saffir-Simpson scale for hurricanes. Or we may not know at all, but we know that Category 1 is a tropical storm, or close to a tropical storm, and Category 4 is bad. So I think this is something.
Well, we know the scale for earthquakes too, the Richter scale. I mean, everything has a scale.
Yes, we do. And I think this is a reasonable scale. Now, if other Bigfoot explorers who are out there and are investigating and doing and getting sightings, let me know what you think. If we need to change this, I'd like to. But I want this to be something that we can all work on as a community. And I'm glad you were excited about it, and I wanted to share it with some folks. I sent a copy to a friend or two right before the show, and I'll see what they think. But I believe it could do us some good.
To me, it makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, like you need to know where the hotspots are, where the activity is, where's dangerous, where's not dangerous. And having the different colour schemes, like if people can plot their sighting and put it on a level to that scale, then we can get the different colour patterns and be able to work the whole thing out and make it a lot, yeah.
Well, here's the real...
believe in it, yeah.
Here's the real benefit. If you've got a map in front of you and you can see the color coding and you can know that, well, if I go north of here, there have not been good interactions. So I might want to stay away from there. And south of me, it might be a little better. Because let's face it, if the Bigfoot creature has bad experiences with humans in one area but does not have those bad experiences somewhere else, you know, if you're a little concerned or just one or two of you going out, you might want to go where the experiences have not been so bad. Maybe there's mutual interaction or just Bigfoot interaction or witness interaction. You know, I think that's what's important. It's a way to categorize. It's a way to analyze data. As a scientist, I'm always trying to analyze data so that we learn more. And the more we know, the better off we are. Let's face it. So I'm glad you think it's reasonable. Please let all your friends know down there in Australia and around the world.
Basically.
Just check it out. If you go to BigfootColumn.com, it's in the upper right corner. Now, I will say this. Everything is hosted right now at scarycast.com. We're going to do a big new redesign on Sunday for scarycast.com. So there'll be a link to each of the shows, Paranormal Down Under, Scarycast, Bigfoot and Company, and the Bigfoot Column. So there'll be a link to each one of the shows. Each one will have its own page. It'll be easy for everyone to find. And that's what we want it to do. I want to make sure that people can find it. And also, it'll help when you're searching for it. You can find it better. But I can tell you, we're doing well. We have a lot of listeners now on iTunes, Spotify, and Spreaker. We are having a ton of listeners.
Yep.
And thank you to all the listeners. We have a gigantic crowd live on Scarycast with William Rodriguez. I was really impressed with that guy. He's somebody we're going to have on several times because he's up there in Northeast Georgia. He's familiar with Bigfoot. He makes Indian flutes. He does a lot of Native American flute. He makes Native American flute. He has seminars that people can go to. Just a super, super guy. And he's someone that I want to really introduced to the Scarycast and Paranormal Down Under and Bigfoot and Company group. I think
that's
the more
right.
good people we meet, I mean, I just think the more good people we meet, the more knowledge we get. So everybody watch out. Hey, Jackson, I'll tell you what, I might ask William to come on with us in a couple of weeks on Paranormal Down Under. Would that be okay?
Oh, that'd be excellent. I'd love to talk to him and pick his mind.
Yeah, and he lives in, yes, sir. Yeah.
I was just going to say one thing. We'll have to let Matt Delf know about the scale that we've come up with because he's a lot like me. He just goes out camping on his own. If he comes across the zero, he might need a little bit of backup. So we'll have to let Mr. Matt Delf know about the scale because
I
know you put your finger at me when you said that I go out on my own, and I know he does as well, so...
Right. I was going to let him know in the morning because I think tonight he worked and I didn't want to bother him. So in the morning at 7 o'clock when he's normally my first phone call between 7 and 7:30 when I fill him in on the Bigfoot news of the night. So he'll get the phone call in the morning. So I'll make sure he knows about that. And Tom Cantrell up in Washington, our good buddy, and Mark Johnston up in Vancouver, you know, got a lot of our good friends. I'll let them know. Jen Cruz, she sent me a nice text. So it's wonderful to have friends out in the field. I do a lot
It is.
More, I guess, I do a lot more paranormal research. I do a little bit of Bigfoot, but I do a lot of paranormal. Like, for example, in fact, in case people don't know what I do, like I was up in Northeast Georgia. I was at the Dome Houses. I was at a location where they have some amazing kind of super secret technology that they work on. And I talk about, I'm familiar a lot with Indian legends, and I go out and try to explore them. Right now, we just had, in fact, I want to tell everybody about this. We just had Mary Joyce on our show. She has got a book called The Cherokee Little People Are Real. And I got to thank Jen Cruz, 2 weeks ago, talked about the little people. Mary Joyce was on Bigfoot and Company last week and talked about the little people. William talked about the little people. I have been getting story after story after story of the little people. And I'm developing a relationship with the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation now. And I'm going to get to meet some of these great storytellers. I am on the hunt for the little people. We're going to find them. I'm excited. I hope they like me. I hope they'll come out. And also, William is involved in a fairy con, F-A-E-R-Y, you know, the real little people. And that is very close to Clayton, Georgia, in Rabun County. So it seems as though right now I'm getting pulled into the little people and trying to find them, and I hope to meet them. So we'll see. People say what they want, but I know what experience has shown. And sometimes my scientific buddies, they have a term, Jackson. They call my research into the paranormal, they call it scientifical, but it's science.
Mm-hmm.
Scientifical, I think it's kind of a nasty term. It says, you know, you're trying to use scientific procedures on things that aren't real. Well, I'll tell you what, about 150 years ago, there were a lot of things that people thought were not real that turned out to be. So just because the National Science Foundation will not fund it doesn't mean that it's not real. I'll be quiet now. I'll get off my I'll get off my soapbox and get back to Paranormal Down Under with Jackson Samael. We're having a great time. And all the folks that are listening, got a crowd in tonight. Yeah, we got about 15, 18 people listening right now, and they keep adding, which is great. Anyway, Jackson, we were going to talk about tonight Planet X. We talked about Planet X on Scarycast, and a lot of our listeners are more international, and we haven't talked about Planet X. Why don't you start our discussion, and then I'll chime in. How's that, buddy?
That's fine with me. Well, Planet X, I've been researching Planet X for probably the last 10, 12 years or so, since I was first become aware of it, and reading into it. I discovered that the Sumerians knew about it like 6,000 years ago. But they have a whole different spell. Like, they're the first people that had a written language, the Sumerian cuneiform. Now, for those people that don't know, the Sumerians lived on the between the Euphrates and the Tigris River, where Afghanistan is now.
We call that Iraq and Afghanistan. That whole general area was the Sumerians, Iraq and Afghanistan. Yes, sir.
Exactly.
And a little bit of Iran, basically modern-day Iran.
Now, they've from their written text that has been translated, like through Zachariah Sitchin, I'm sure you've heard of him, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers have too. He's done a lot of research into this. And, oh, yeah. He's an absolute legend, that man. And what he's translating from what I've researched and everything is that the Sumerians, like in Genesis, they basically write about the 7 days, how the earth came about. In the Sumerian text, they write about how the whole solar system came about. And they had their own names for all the different planets and everything. And they talk about Nemesis coming through which is basically a red dwarf star. They call it almost like a sister sun to our sun, and it's known as the Destroyer, Nemesis. There's a couple of other names, and it's basically a minor solar system, and it's on an elliptical loop that passes around Pluto, then around the sun, and then between us and the sun roughly every 3,600 years. Like, the last one they can calculate was roughly around the time of Noah's flood. So I guess you get an idea of what sort of thing happens. It's also known as the planet, the system of the crossing, because the way it crosses in an elliptical orbit around our solar system, nothing like any other thing crosses around our planet. Now, there's one that we've described as the Blue Bonnet. I've spoken to you with the Blue Bonnet. We've got that on as on our webpage. Now, this planet Nibiru, like, it's incredible. The Sumerians have, as I said, all these different names for the planets. Earth was allegedly a planet called Tiamat, and it was located between Mars and Jupiter, not where it is now. When Nibiru came through and Nemesis back in the time, allegedly struck Tiamat, crossed genetics microscopic things that the asteroid belt that we now see between Mars and Jupiter is actually half of what Earth was. That's the remnants of the other half of Earth. Earth got pushed completely out of orbit. Now that's why it's between Mars and Venus. A lot of stuff goes on out there in space that we don't understand, but somehow, the Sumerians 4,500 years ago got this. Oh, sorry, longer than that, 6,500 years ago, had this story given to them about Nibiru coming through. They genetically changed the hominids on Earth into Homo sapiens to become slaves. Now, this is what I've written. What I've read. That's why we can't find a missing link.
Because there is no missing link. Right?
No, there is no missing link. There is no missing link. We're all genetically changed. And through the Sumerian text, like, I believe the Sumerian text above all others, because Sumeria was taken over by the Babylonians. And then you get the Babylonian text. And the Bible and the Quran were written from that text. So all of the stories of the later books were written from the original. Where they describe how the solar system came about, not just how about Earth came about in 7 days. They describe the entire creation of the solar system, the planets, how things happened. I'm thinking, how could people 6,500 years ago have this sort of knowledge? It's quite incredible when you really, really think about it. Like, yeah, as going back to the missing link, like, I believe there is no missing link because when the Anunnaki, I'm sure you've heard of the Anunnaki and so on, when they came through on Nibiru, they genetically modified the subspecies we had here that had the most intelligence, which were the Neanderthal or so on, and they got them to be, they gave them just enough intelligence to work them as slaves. Allegedly, Planet X, Nibiru, had a hole in their ozone layer, is like what we're getting today, and they've discovered that gold dust can reflect ozone and heat, as what we use gold on the space shuttle and everything today is reflective heat and, you know, something to take that in. So it's they allegedly got us as slaves to mine gold for them, to turn the gold dust to put in their atmosphere to protect their atmosphere. And that's where a whole lot of other stuff comes into about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life and the Tree of Knowledge and the Serpent and the Fallen and the Watchers. And it gets quite interesting. I wish we could have 6 hours to talk about this.
Yeah, I want to interject something about this Planet X business. First of all, I would say in 2011, 2012, I thought the whole notion was idiotic. I don't think it's idiotic now. I think that there's a lot to it. But here's my take on it, and I've got to talk to an astrophysicist about this, because I don't think that planetary system can possibly come as close as people say it does, because if it did, the satellites or the planets around that red dwarf system would get captured by the sun. They get captured in an orbit that might be that would not work out for us, and we would see that that red dwarf or brown dwarf, whichever one it really is, it would look like a binary star system, which we're starting to see some evidence of that now in some photographs, and it's a little disturbing for folks. But the whole point is, I personally don't think that the Nemesis system comes as close as other people have said, just because if it did, some of those satellites, the sun is so gigantic, and it really is, I think it would capture some things. But that's just me. That's just me talking. And I want to get an astrophysicist on here to run a few calculations and talk to us about, well, really, how close could that Nemesis get here that it would disrupt things on Earth but not destroy things on Earth? See, I think, just what little bit I know about celestial mechanics, I think that if something comes around, I mean, just near the Mars orbit, it's going to disrupt the heck out of the Earth. And that's when we're going to have Noah's flood. That's when we're going to have Exodus and all that. So I don't know. And I'm trying. I've got this gentleman's. He's an astrophysicist, and he's in North Carolina. And he said he'd be willing to come on the show and talk to us. I've got his information, and whenever I think about it, I try to call him. He always has a day off because at that observatory they work 7 days a week. And I always seem to catch him on his day off. Maybe I can call him tomorrow because we'll be headed down to a Comic-Con. But I would like to talk to an astrophysicist to give us some calculations about how close could Nemesis really get that it would cause a problem. Because I just don't think it's going to get as close as some people want to say that. But that's just me. And we'll find out. I'm going to, again, just trying to be a little bit of a scientist here and go with what we know. So anyway, I'm not putting any cold water on it. I believe wholeheartedly in the binary star system idea of sun and Nemesis. I believe in the fact that there are planets orbiting around it, but I just don't think they can get that close to the sun, or the sun would wrench those planets into an orbit around the sun. That's just what I think. So we'll find out. I'll do some research and.
Could I just read you a little bit from what was translated from the Sumerian texts?
Please. Go right ahead.
Now, Planet X is known as Marduk. Earth was known as Tiamat to the Sumerians. They say that the path of Marduk took him towards the giants Saturn and Jupiter. Marduk neared Saturn and Jupiter. Their massive gravitational pulls bent his orbit drastically inward, forcing his path to be aimed directly at Tiamat. The gravitational pulls of the two giants also caused three chunks of Marduk to be pulled from his body. They too became satellites to encircle Marduk. That's how he became a smaller solar system, like a smaller. As he, now seven satellites, as we know, moved towards Tiamat and her 11 satellites. See, Earth had 11 satellites. The force of Marduk passing caused huge electrical and gravitational disturbance. Tiamat, that ripped her and one of her moons named Evil Wind. Hit Tiamat, splitting, but not quite breaking her in two. So that's why it's smaller than what it is now, and why the asteroid belt out there is believed to be part of Earth. The extra satellites of Earth were also knocked away, smashing them to pieces. The paths they were then thrown into were clockwise, like Marduk's. Their paths were... they became really large elliptical orbits around the sun, changing into the comets which regularly revisit our solar system. The encounter between Marduk and Tiamat caused her orbit to bend even more, resulting in his becoming a planet or god, which was destined to encircle the sun forever, why we call it the crossing. Because he's now trapped in an orbit, destiny was to return to the scene of the collision. Now, that's what they basically say, like, Nibiru passes Tiamat, Earth, for a second time, and this time, Nibiru's gravity hits Earth and rips it into two halves. The lower part of Earth was smashed into pieces to become the asteroid belt that to this day remains in orbit around the sun, between Mars and Jupiter, where Tiamat, where we used to sit. The asteroid belt was called the Hammered Bracelet, as we still know it. This second collision formed the basis of the creation story, and the Hammered Bracelet, which was basically mistranslated as firmament, is now named as heaven. So that's sort of saying something right there.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that I will say, when you talk about the fact that Earth has had many satellites, well, from what I have seen, it does have a second satellite. It's very small. And there are other claims that Earth has additional satellites. I mean, I don't know. I'm not part of the astronomical community. But there are claims that Earth has at least two, if not more, satellites. So the fact that it yeah. might have had 14 at one point, well, I mean, you know, that's neither here nor there. It's certainly reasonable. And
I'm just going back to the Sumerian text, which is the oldest written known text. And if that was written at the time, then yeah, I sort of tend to believe that. It's so in depth. It's how could people from back then have so much knowledge and be able to name every planet in our solar system 7,000 years ago? It's quite incredible. Not they named Venus and a couple of other planets. Oh, not Venus. Uranus and Neptune and a couple of others. Like before, we even had telescopes to say, "Yep, they are actually there." The Dogon tribe in South Africa. Like they knew all about the Dog Star. They say they came from the Dog Star, which is that was only discovered in the 1940s by telescope. You know, Sirius A and Sirius B. And they had knowledge of this in an African, village 1,000 years ago. So there's so much more that we need to discover. There's so much more we need to learn from the past to find out about everything more, to find out where we're going, because everything works in cycles. If we can discover our past, we'll learn more about our future and where we're going. That's just my perception.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I agree 100%. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting things about Planet X. Now, my buddy Marshall Masters.
Yep.
He's kind of the Planet X guru. And he's got the theory that Nemesis is going to come close, number one. Number two, it's going to cause a lot of damage. And he is starting to get photographs of a second dim star that seems to be near our star. The sun, either at sunrise or sunset. So I think it's just kind of interesting that, we're starting to see some evidence of this. And I mean, who knows what can happen? I just certainly hope that we don't have all these problems, you know. There's a lot going on with the Planet X stuff. There was, we had the whole hysteria back leading up to 2012, and I kind of had a feeling that nothing bad was going to happen, and it didn't. I was very fortunate that I was right. I'm glad for all of us. But we've got to be careful because we don't know what's going to happen. There are a lot of crazy things that are happening. And Jackson, I'm going to throw something into the mix that I'd like for us to talk about, not this week, but maybe in an upcoming show, is the idea of the hollow moon. And that comes from the book by Ingo Swann called Penetration. In fact, I've even got a copy of that, I think, on scarycast.com. You can go look and find it. But the whole point about that is that maybe 10,000 years ago, odd amount of time, probably pretty close to two passes or two and a half passes of the Nibiru system, that a round odd object became put in the orbit of Earth. And of course, the moon makes no sense. It orbits right on the equator. It is perfectly spherical. It orbits. It turns once when it goes around. No other satellite of any other planet does that. It's absolutely like it's, how can I put it? Is that it's really fake. It's actually a satellite in terms of maybe a spaceship.
We only see one side.
Well, it spins once as it makes its pass around. And I mean, I just think there's something so odd about the moon. I think somebody said, and I forget who it was someone who I really respect. They said, you know, the moon makes absolutely no sense as being a satellite of the Earth. And I kind of agree with that.
Yep.
But anyway, you know, that's something I'd like for us to talk about.
I've done a lot of research and seen quite a few things on why man hasn't been back to the moon since the 1970s. I've seen quite a few documentaries, done a lot of research where it says that we've been warned off the moon not to go back because it's already got bases on there by the Greys and that. That's just throwing it out there as well. That's what I've seen.
That's right. That's right there in Ingo Swann's book, Penetration. So that's easy enough to find. It's a free PDF, free download. Just type in Ingo space Swann space PDF, free PDF, and there you go. You can all find a copy of Penetration, and he talks about that exact concept. So, you know, that's a good one. But anyway, you know, back to the topic at hand, which is of course Nibiru and Planet X. It's just a really interesting topic.
Yep.
And so do you have anything else from the Sumerians that you would like to get out tonight? Because that's always very interesting. In fact, I've got my four Sakurai Sitchin books right here. Sitchin,
yep.
I apologize, I mispronounced it. I've got my four books right here, and I'm trying to get through them as, I don't know, about 1,800 pages worth of book, and it takes a long time, but they're great things, and everybody needs to go out and buy a copy, I think. So anyway, after you, sir, what comments do you have about Planet X and Nibiru?
Okay, well, apparently with the Sumerians, the destruction of Tiamat on the second passing, when it actually collided, and the corresponding creation of Earth out of the wreckage that resulted in the melting of the ice-covered surface, because we were covered in ice back then, the remaining land masses of Tiamat, or Earth, concentrated in one spot as a continent, which is Pangaea, which is what we know of, you know, which was the main reason that we have the main Pacific Ocean now, led by them, is that where the impact was, that's why there's no landmass in the Pacific Ocean. Like, that's where that half of the planet got taken away. That's why land's concentrated on the other two-thirds of the planet. It all just got moved around. That was back then. As a result of the collision between Nibiru and Tiamat, or Earth, the alteration of the order of the planets, satellite of Saturn, or Gaga, as it was known to the Sumerians, that was jolted out of its orbit as well to take into a new orbit around the sun as it plundered itself. Big collision, like, it was just huge. The way it was described to the Sumerians, because it was all given to them from the Anunnaki, allegedly. And the creation epic proceeding from the point of the collision, as told by the ancient Sumerians, corresponds exactly with the Hebrew tradition as told in Genesis. They both collaborate with the assumptions made by science. So sort of goes into it. Beginning of the eruption and flowing of molten rocks, which sent volcanic debris and everything into formless skies, all three disciples, as they called them, detailed the creation of an atmosphere as a result of the accumulation of clouds and mists which blocked out certain amounts of the sun's heat. That resulted in the cooling of the molten rock to form the continents and the creation of water to surround the continents, as the oceans from the lands, waters and atmosphere. And then we got the mountains and everything when we got hot spots. So, sort of gives you a pretty good idea, like, yeah, as I said before, when you go back to look at the Sumerian text and everything, it tells you a whole lot more about the creation of the solar system than just the creation of the Earth and how things came apart. And I find this so interesting, and yeah, I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, it is really interesting, and I think it's something people would enjoy reading. I have my copies, and I'm going to do that. So that is a little bit of a profile of Planet X, and I think it's something, you know, we'll keep talking about. I'll get some folks on here.
Definitely.
You know, some more guests we want to bring. I'd like to get Marshall Masters on here because I'd like for him to talk to more of an international audience like we have here, which is great. And
I'd also like to down the track talk about the theory of the hollow Earth. If you've gotten into that much at all,
we had Brooks Agnew on ScaryCast about, I don't know, 4 months ago. I know he's been busy. I haven't been able to really talk to him, but the Hollow Earth is very interesting. I find it very interesting. He's got some interesting thoughts on it. We'll see. We'll see what we got on it. We got the Hollow Moon, we got the Hollow Earth, we got the Flat Earth. We got so many different concepts. They're kind of fun. They're really fun to talk about, and those are some things that, you know, that we want to talk more about. So I think that I guess to kind of put a cap on the Planet Earth, I mean the Planet X thing, is based on observations that people are making at sundown and sunup. There are some little dots of light that seem to be accompanying the sun. We don't know what they are. The press certainly doesn't want to talk about them. Scientists don't want to talk about them. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. However, we will. I've got a fellow that I'm going to get on here. He's a survivalist, and he has some theories about this, and I will get him on Paranormal Down Under here in a couple of weeks. He and I are talking about some things that we can discuss. And because in case anybody doesn't know, these shows don't happen overnight. It takes 3 to 4 weeks to produce a show in general and to get everything together so that you have enough information for a show. So it's, you know, it's a little bit of work, but it's something we all certainly enjoy. So, Jackson, I'll tell you what do you have to wrap up with everybody for this week? And, of course, we'll be back next week. But what do you have to wrap up for everybody this week?
Okay, well, this week I'm probably going to head out bush, do a little bit more trekking next week or so, set up a few more trail cams, whatever, go out and see what I can find. I'll always be looking at the skies. I never stop looking at the skies. Doing some more research on, I'll be looking more into the hollow moon so that I'll have a lot more to talk about with that. And doing some research on a few other things so that, you know, we've always got something really interesting to talk about and to engage our listeners.
Absolutely, we do. And everybody check out that book, Penetration by Ingo Swann. That's free on the internet. Just Ingo Swann Penetration PDF free, and you can find a copy. And that will get everybody, you know, kind of going on that. It's very interesting. I had a chance to meet. Ingo was a remote viewer with the Stargate Project. He was considered the best of the remote viewers, and had a lot of turmoil in his life, and passed away. Might have been some questions about that. We don't know, but he was a good guy, and he certainly could do a great job as a remote viewer. So I want everyone to be sure to pick up on his work. So Jackson, I tell you what, I guess we'll get back to research and working hard, and we'll be back next week. We might be on at a different day and time, just because I will be out of town. So we'll let everybody know, and thank you for being here as my co-host on Paranormal Down Under. You have a good week. I'll do my best to have a good week, and all of our friends that have been here a week, we'll see you next week on Paranormal Down Under. Sound good?
Yep, most definitely. You have safe travels there, Dr. John, and enjoy your week. And
you too.
I'll say hello again to all of our listeners out there, and you guys all have a great week as well, and look forward to you tuning in for the next show.
All right, everybody take care. Bye-bye.